This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon, welcome to The Bigger Picture. I'm Lim Suan. You're about to hear an edited recording of the webinar titled Reflections on the Malaysia Education Blueprint. This was the second of six webinars which explores Malaysia's education challenges with a specific focus on the education blueprint. This series was a collaboration between BFM Media, Adunity Foundation and G25 Malaysia.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to our Education Awareness Webinar Series brought to you by Edunity Foundation, G25 and BFM. After about 55 years of independence, there was this realization that the development of Malaysia's education system did not grow in tandem with economic growth or in proportion to the changing demands of education in general. So there was an urgent need to implement progressive change in the education sector to create a generation of Malaysian scholars on par, if not better than the top performing students of our regional peers. A holistic solution was required, which led to the formulation of the Malaysia Education Blueprint 2013 to 2025, which was launched on the 6th of September 2013. This is a large scale plan to transform the Malaysian public education system with a focus on teacher support, improving core skills among students, accelerating system improvements, and increased operational flexibility. Today, we're going to reflect on this Malaysia Education Blueprint. We've only got about 3 over years left to go to 2025. And joining me to help us understand the thinking behind the blueprint and where we have come this far, how far have we actually come, are Dato Sri Idris Jalla, President and Chairman of Pemandu Associates. Welcome, Dato Sri. How are you today?
I'm very well, thank you.
And joining us also, Chen Li Kai, Trustee at Teach for Malaysia and Senior Partner at McKinsey & Co. Welcome, Li Kai.
Thank you for having me, Mira.
Okay, I'm going to start with Idris. You were instrumental in dedicating a lab at Pemandu, specifically for education. Why did you feel so strongly about this at that time, Idris?
Well, education is a very important agenda for any nation. I would say education is the bedrock for a nation's success. Because talent, if we have good talent in a country, it's like petrol in a car. If you have a car and you have petrol, then it can move. So it's a very important aspect. What we did, why I thought the labs was useful was, it's a tool that was important that we bring all the relevant parties together. And we had even the Prime Minister, the Deputy Prime Minister visiting the lab. We have the representative from principals, we have teachers. We have representatives from parents inside there. We syndicated with students and we brought experts from outside the country to come there so that all the ideas were mooted inside there and stress tested. We had McKinsey as well inside the labs. And so we really found a way. We garnered the information, the ideas from everybody to put it. It's such an important agenda. So we thought we had to find a very radical way to get the best thought processes to form it. That's why the labs, we had actually two rounds of labs. One was in 2009, and the second round of labs was in 2012. That's when we founded the Malaysian Education Blueprint in the second lab. But the first labs in 2009 was part of the economic or the GTP. And that was when we were the foundation, the precursor for the MEB.
Help us understand, the lab two was for the blueprint. What was that lab supposed to be doing?
Well, what we did in the lab was we studied what was implemented since the first round of labs, and we found there were areas that we needed to improve on it. And there were basically, we call them 11 shifts, the many things that we were prioritizing to work on. But if you take the various shifts and categorize them in three main thrusts, one was about access to education, quality education. The second one was about quality of education. The third was about equity, that there needs to be equity in terms of access to it, so everybody in the country needs to benefit from it. Those were the three main ones. But the 11 thrusts were the specific interventions that we needed to address those three main pillars.
Yeah, so equity, access, and quality, the three main things. Yeah. Li Kai, any reflections on the National Education Blueprint? I mean, we were clear. Were you clear or were we clear about the what, how and why for education reform in Malaysia?
I think at the time of the blueprint, this building on what Idris has said in 2012, 2013, there was a very clear burning platform for education reform at the time. And our education system was in nothing less than a crisis. At the time, in terms of international assessments, Malaysia was in the bottom third of countries across reading, math, and science. So we were in the same performance category as countries like Moldova, Ghana, Western Cape in Africa, Botswana, and so on. So we're in the bottom third. We had gone from a ranking of 10th, for example, in TIMSS in 2003, all the way down to the bottom third. We had massive equity gaps. When we talk about equity, quality, and access, there are massive equity gaps in the system. In many ways, where a student was born was a primary determinant of learning outcomes. If you happen to be born in the states like Sarawak, Sabah, or Kedah at the time, chances are your educational outcomes will be much, much worse than if you were born in Putrajaya. So massive equity challenges. In terms of quality, our students were also lagging significantly behind other countries. So in international assessments, again, the average Malaysian 15-year-old student was about 3.5 years behind their peers in Singapore. So in other words, the average 15-year-old Malaysian student was performing at the equivalent of a 12 or 11-year-old in Singapore or in Hong Kong. So there were significant challenges at the time. And I think the labs was a model to take the challenges, take the lessons, take the international learnings, and try to move forward.
Dato Sri, would you agree with Lee Kai? I mean, is it really equity when it comes to where you're born, where you go to school? I mean, you grew up in Barrio in Sarawak. I mean, I think you'd be the best person to actually share with us whether or not inequity is really a huge problem when it comes to geographical locations, access, infrastructure, you know, that kind of thing. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think it's true that you could say that there are a lot of difficulties in rural areas, but it shouldn't be an excuse for not improving the quality. I remember at the time when we were there, we basically didn't have what you have today in many schools. You know, I remember the kids, we really wanted to study. I remember at the time, everybody told me that if you pass your exams, that's your passport to see the world. I wanted to see the town. And if you fail your exams, you cannot come to town. So for me, passing the exam was just life and death. I remember when I finished my Form 3, the first time I came to town in Marudi, there were 15 of us who passed our Sarawak Junior exams, and we went to our school in Marudi. I think the first term exams, from number 1 to number 10, they were all from my class. So the town kids wondering, where are these kids coming from? Because they didn't realize that when we were studying, we was life and death. And if you didn't pass it, it's almost like death. So I think my point is this. Despite the hindrances and the difficulties, if the kids really wanted to study and their parents really get them to study, you'll do well. So I always say, yes, it's true, but the government can do what it can to provide as much facilities. But if the students don't want to study, that's the bedrock of it all. I mean, it all begins with the student. And we're not stepping back and say, oh, the problem with the curriculum. It really is to do with the students.
You know, Lika, drawing up the Malaysia Education Blueprint, it took a systematic approach, didn't it? Can you help us understand what that process was like? How did you come up with 11 strategic and operational shifts? I mean, they're pretty, I mean, I'm looking at all 11, right? It's lovely. You've covered just about everything in this blueprint. How did you come up with it? I mean, what was the approach or understanding?
If I understand at the time, similar to how Idris described it, the Ministry of Education, on the basis of the labs, came out with this concept of the 10 shifts. And these 10 shifts were very much built around what are the drivers of improvement. Right? So like Idris was saying, a lot of it is around the students. How do we improve learning outcomes? Students, how do we better support them? It's around schools, it's around principals, it's around the teachers, it's around the efficiency of the system. So the process was, upon reflection, fairly thorough. The Ministry of Education at the time undertook what was, I think at the time, the largest national dialogue conducted across every single state, consulted with tens of thousands of teachers, with parents, with stakeholders, private sector. There were the labs where these strategy initiatives were formulated. And some of the shifts, I think, are quite powerful. And so this one of the shifts around transforming teaching into the profession of choice. in terms of how do we make teaching not the profession last resort, but where our best and brightest, our most energetic, our most motivated professionals are in. There were shifts around how to strengthen the leadership, empower the state education departments, the JPDs, the district education offices, DPDs, to customize solutions. So it was meant as upon a close reading of the blueprint, meant as a quite a comprehensive reform of the system from a starting point where we were in crisis.
Idris, which is the biggest lever to actually pull in all of this to get reforms going, education reforms going in this country?
I think there were two in my mind. One is the principal, focusing in the teachers, because everything revolves around what's happening in the classroom. So if the teachers don't do their job every day to teach according to the right teaching methods, and obviously the principal is the person that makes sure they do. So this must happen every single day. But of course, the biggest lever, because the students want to study, if they don't do study, you're gone. But it's really about the teachers. We all have been to school. I'm sure Likai, you all remember the best teachers that you had in your time. You can tell who was a better teacher than the other teacher. I can tell. If I look back, all my teachers, I knew I did well in that class for that particular subject because the teacher was very, very good. So I believe that the biggest lever to pull is the individual teachers. And of course, the person that makes them do it is the principal. So I stick with that simply because if you look today, we have the same curriculum, the same syllabus all across the country. But how come some schools are doing better than others? So you really have to look at it. And you all know when you study that, it's very clear if the teachers are doing their jobs well, and obviously the principals are really very, very good and dedicated, that's where the starting point is. I still believe that the classroom is where the biggest lever to pull.
We have about 420,000 teachers. Now, that's a lot of teachers. So what's wrong? Why is quality of teachers a problem in this country? 420,000 is a pretty big number, would you say?
I had a session with a guy, Professor Rimmer. Professor Rimmer is from Harvard. He did a lot of research on what is the thing that really kick and make happen for some teachers and not others. This was done in international research. And they found the biggest thing that differentiate between the teachers that are good and teachers that are not good, the teaching methods that each teacher uses. So when you look at pedagogy, the way in which the particular teacher teach geography, for example, he has differently compared to others. They both probably have the same degree, or maybe the same, they went to the same school, they went to the same college, they passed the same exam. One does a better job than the other in the classroom. It's all to do with the teaching methods, the methods that they use. So if you pull out the very best teachers for geography, history, and maths, and interview them, show me your teaching methods. Let me codify that so that I can use for the other 400,000 teachers. I can tell you, Mira, we make huge leap and bound progress. That's because it's nothing to do with the curriculum, the same curriculum, but it's the way that particular teacher teaches it.
How do we fix this, you know? How do we address this?
Maybe two facts to provide some context, Mira, also to your question around the 400,000 teachers. So we have 400,000 teachers in the system today. That means we have about a student-teacher ratio of about 1 to 14, which is already one of the best in Asia. We have one of the best teacher-student ratios in Asia. At the beginning of about 20 years ago, we had about 250,000 teachers in the system. We had a teacher-student ratio of about 1 to 20. So we've dramatically increased the number of teachers in the system over a period of 10 years leading up to the blueprint. But we haven't necessarily focused on investing, increasing the quality of either the intake as well as the quality of the pedagogy, like Idris has said, of our teachers. We've got great teachers in the system, but the challenge is about lifting all of them. So one of the things the blueprint highlighted was prior to the blueprint, in terms of the percentage of teachers who were entering the teacher training institutes, 70% of them had about 0 to 3 A's in SPM. And this is not to say that academic results are the best predictor of teaching quality, no. But 70% of teachers had 0 to 3 A's going into teacher training institutions. I think one of the big shifts as part of blueprint was shifting towards having at least 70% of the teaching intake had at least 7 A's in SPM. So that was one step in terms of dramatically increasing the quality of our teaching intake. But then with 400,000 teachers in the system, 50% of our teachers will still be teaching for the next next 20 years. So then there's a big focus in terms of needing to enhance professional development, providing more support to our teachers to enhance the pedagogy, getting better quality teaching and maybe even better consistency in teaching across schools and in classrooms. I think that will need to be an important focus going forward.
So 50% of our teachers qualified in SPM have 0 to 3 A's, and that's we've got 50%, yeah. Right? So how do we up our game? Is that even possible?
Yeah, I think that is the big challenge, right? And I think in some ways this is the single biggest lever. And as you just pointed out, unless we improve pedagogy, unless we improve quality instruction in classrooms, nothing else that happens at the ministry level, nothing else that happens at the policy level matters. And the most important thing is improving teaching quality. And therefore, thinking through in terms of when we invest in the education system, when we spend, it's not necessarily how much we spend, but where we spend it on.
I want to jump in here. Mira, you know, we don't want these people to get so despondent to listen to us talking about how difficult it is. Let me tell you three stories. When I was in government, I visited three schools which were among the top 100 high-performing schools. I went to Sri KDU, and I also went to Sekolah Ulu Lubai. It's a very rural school in the heartland of Sarawak. And I also went to school in PJ, Sekolah Menengah, I think it's Taman Mega. When I met the principal, I spent a day with each of them. I was struck by what was common among them, how they drill a teaching method. And the most startling example was Sekolah Ulu Lubai in Limbang, rural part of Limbang. The principal is the name of Chego Jaul. He said, my teachers are the same quality as all the other teachers in the whole of Malaysia. But every single one of our kids here, they pass our school with flying colors. Up to one standard, primary 1, 2, and 3, they all have 100% literacy and numeracy. And I mean, all of them belong to the category Lika talked about. So the question was, what were they doing? You know what time they turn up in the classroom? Everybody come to the classroom at Longhouse 6, 7:30 a.m. in the morning. They all drill them to read and write. At lunch times, the parents bring the food to them. Night time, they have private study there, and the parents are in the classroom for private study, and the kids are really working. And if trust me, the whole classroom was littered with accolades. They won so many awards, including Commonwealth Awards for top schools and etc. It was an amazing story. There was this guy, the principal, came to one education seminar and he told a story. There was one principal from school in Kelantan that said, look, I'm going to send to you 20 of my kids who cannot read and write. Will you take the challenge and put them in Sekolah Ulu Lubai and then you teach them using your methods? Challenge accepted. So that they send those 20 Kelantanese kids to the school. I think 2 months later, Sandek Center all can read and write. Again, teaching methods, same quality and standard of teachers everywhere amongst the 400,000. So I believe there's tremendous hope if we really take a very simple approach to talk to the principals of this high-performing school. Don't listen to Likai and me. Talk to them. They'll tell you exactly how to do. Because frankly speaking, don't find out how Finland is doing in Norway. Talk to the best principals in the school. And if you spend a few days talking to them, you know exactly what needs to be done.
You're listening to an edited recording of the second episode from our education webinar series titled Reflections on the Malaysia Education Blueprint. This series was a collaboration between BFM Media, Adunisi Foundation and G25 Malaysia. We'll be right back shortly on BFM 89.9. Welcome back to The Bigger Picture. You are listening to an edited recording of the second episode from our education webinar series, which was a collaboration between BFM Media, Adunisi Foundation and G25 Malaysia. This episode discussed the process and thinking that went into the Malaysia Education Blueprint and how it compares with educational reforms in other countries. Here's more of that conversation featuring host Mira Sivasodhi and panelists Dato' Sri Idris Jalla, President and Chairman of Mamandu Associates, and Chen Li Kai, Trustee of Teach for Malaysia and Senior Partner from McKinsey & Co.
Lika, you've studied so many education systems in the world. And yes, you're right, Idris. A lot of us here look at Finland and Norway and all of that. But is that necessarily what we need to do, Lika?
I think there is a misconception in education reform that we always need to look at certain countries in terms of what's best. And so there's this premise of, look, let's look to Finland, let's look to Singapore, let's look to Estonia in terms of what best practices are. My sense is that in education reform, it's not necessarily about best practice, it's about relevant practice. So for example, as Idris has pointed out, we have great schools, we've got fast improving schools, we've got great teachers and principals in every state and almost every district. We do not necessarily need to look outside. We need to look at inside in terms of where these bright sparks are, where these spots of light are. Let's find out what they're doing, let's replicate it, and let's learn from them. And to your point, Mira, when we look at education system reforms globally, the unfortunate thing is almost every country, every system tries to do education reform. But yeah. 70% of education reforms globally fail. And they fail because of a few reasons. Not necessarily because of lack of funding, not necessarily because the plan was bad. But they fail primarily because of two reasons. One is they try to adopt interventions, or they try to adopt reforms, which are not relevant to them. They try to adopt reforms, for example, from Finland or from Singapore, which is not relevant to their context. Or systems try to adopt reforms where, because they've been successful in the past, I just keep on doing what I'm doing. I just try to replicate what I've done in the past without moving forward. Because one of the quite inspiring things when we look at school system reform globally is there is almost a science to school system reform. When you look at the 20 to 30 most improved school systems over the last 15 or 20 years, there is a certain improvement journey that all school systems go through. Every system, irrespective of geography, culture, context, it go from poor performance to fair to good to great to excellent performance. So the challenge is not about learning from Finland, learning from Norway. It's about identifying where are we on the improvement journey and learning relevant practice, not necessarily best practice. And most of it actually comes from within the system.
How do we keep politics out of education? 40 years ago, when we were in school education, it was much broader than just studying. It was social skills, sports, appreciation of those who are not like us, different races, religions. We're all part of school life. How do we bring this back?
I think what we need to do is focus on improving the quality of education. Today, unfortunately, many of the schools that you see, the national schools, there are only Malays are going there. Very few non-Malays are going to the school. So we almost live a parallel life. So many parents, they're reluctant to send to national schools because they find private schools, some of them are better than them. So I think the quality is the key. Let me return back to a very practical example of what we need to do. I like to tell stories. A few years ago, I think it was 2012, that I went to Sri KDU because they had the best teams results in the country at that time. The best PISA result. So I turned up and met Datin Chan, the principal. And the kids, by the way, they do our national curriculum. They also do the O levels, the A levels. They sit for two exams and they all pass. So I asked Datin Chan, what's the secret? When I entered the room, there were books that line up the whole conference table from one end to the other end. He said, I want you to look at the books. He said, these are the books that we use for teaching methods. So every school term, every teacher in the school must come to the classroom for 2 weeks to prepare for the lessons for the next term. 2 weeks. So if they don't pass the standard that they put to them during the 2 weeks to prepare for the term, they extend it for a further week. So you can see the preparation needed in the class before the term begins was excruciating. And this is the reason why the grades, the kids come out from the school, is better than most. If you talk to Datin Chan, you know what you say? The salaries of our teachers the same as the rest. The quality of our teachers the same as the 400,000. But the reason why they're doing well, we insist. And this is no rocket science. So I sincerely believe that if there are any government people that listen to this podcast, etc., I really want to go and talk to the principal of this 100 high-performing schools, robustly find out what they're doing, and then really try to see how we'll apply this across the schools in Malaysia.
the ratio of 1 to 14 between teachers and students, but are they really assigned in the classroom to teach? Is that a problem, Li Kai?
I think there is a difference between the teacher-student ratio and the class sizes. I think, as if I recall in the blueprint, although we have a very good teacher-student ratio, 14 students per teacher across Malaysia, the contact instruction hours of teaching is less than 3 hours a day for the average student. This is not to say that the teacher workload is light. The teaching workload is heavy. A lot of that, of course, is admin, is preparation work, and so on. So although we have a large number of teachers in the system compared to student ratio, the issue is not necessarily the number of teachers. But the research is also showing is school systems that are performing well don't necessarily optimize, they don't necessarily have small class sizes. In fact, school systems that do well often compromise on class sizes. They have smaller number of teachers, they have slightly larger class sizes, because then they can compensate the teachers better, they can have higher quality teaching cohorts in the system, and they can provide limited resources to support these teachers.
What about autonomy, Idris? Do you think schools are empowered to take into consideration who their students are, you know, look at all the different moving parts independently to make decisions? As you said, principals to you in terms of leadership are right on top. So are the principals empowered?
Absolutely. No government in the world, no, including Malaysia, is preventing them from developing teaching methods that are effective in the school. They're totally empowered. So the key here is that picture a constellation. There are three planets. The sun is the student. Three other planets revolving around that sun. The principal and the teacher and the parent. There are three people. So the parent must make sure that kids study at home and finish homework. Sit there every single night to make sure they do the homework. Then the principal making sure that the teachers do their job. The teachers follow the curriculum and make the teachers accountable for the outcome. So those three planets that revolve around the sun, which is the student, principal, the teachers, and the parent. And if you do that, that's how it's going to work. Li Kai and I know, you remember, Li Kai, when we were in government, I wanted the government to rank all the schools in Malaysia, all the 10,000 primary school, the 9,000 secondary school, and we rank every single one of them on the basis of student outcome. The results of the student, and we put them from number 1 to number 10,000. We want to publish them, so the government eventually agreed to publish them in bands. Band 1 means the best, band 7 is the worst. So we publish them. I can tell you, because we know by subject, which teacher is responsible for the kids who are doing very poorly in geography and history for every school. Then you focus on the teacher. You don't look at other teachers. You see? So you look at the grades of the student over a prolonged period of time. So the principal must focus on the teachers, make them accountable for the outcome. By the way, we did that for 3 years. Actually, the results were astounding. A big improvement in the outcome. But people, after 3 years, the government abandoned the whole idea of ranking the schools in that way and publishing the bands. It's sad. I do believe that doing that is causing a silent revolution to take place, because you then hold the teachers accountable, subject by subject, class by class, and you put them directly on the pedestal for all to see.
Yeah, Munir, I think this, if I may, this data-driven approach is absolutely vital in school system reform. Because what data allows us to do is take a differentiated approach to school system reform. So, for example, this the concept of one size fits all. Every school does the same. But one policy for all just doesn't work for school system reform. So what data allows us to do is to say, look, what are the unique challenges that each school is facing? Which schools are underperforming schools? Which schools are struggling? Which schools are doing well? Which schools are doing better? And then that then allows us to target our interventions, right, for each school, each district. So for example, schools that are struggling, they're declining, they're not doing that well. These schools need more support, not less. The schools on the Pearl to Fair journey, they need a bit more scaffolding. They need more support for teachers who are perhaps demotivated or undertrained. They need to set minimum standards. They need more support, whether it's in math and so on. They need more prescriptive support. They need support to get kids back into school. Whereas a school who's performing really well, schools who are thriving, who are improving, who are already some of the best schools in the world, these schools, if we can largely step back as a system, basically allow them to flourish. And then the role of the ministry or the center is then, how do I identify best practices in these well-performing schools, codify and disseminate? How do I encourage schools to collaborate? So it's a very differentiated approach depending on how schools are doing. And then back to your point about autonomy. I'm a big believer in this concept of earned autonomy in school system reform. And earned autonomy as in as you improve, schools get greater autonomy as you get better. A school which is struggling with teachers who are demotivated, students aren't showing up, those schools need much more support, much more resources, not less. And so the concept of earned autonomy based on how schools are performing.
All of this sounds so wonderful. So then brings me to the question, how successful have we been with the implementation of the blueprint and what outcomes have we achieved, Idris? Pemandu was at one point looking at performance management. Till you were left off, how have we done?
When in the first 3 years, when we were doing the school ranking, there was a 75% improvement in band 6 and 7, the worst performing school. 75%, they were reduction because they migrated to become school in the in three band four. And then the increase in the band 1 and 2, there was a nearly 47% increase in the schools in the band 1 and 2. There was a massive shift. If Mira, if you are principal in school in band 7, and you are the principal for 10 years for that school, and they publish you at band 7, the parents are going to come to you, said, Mira, how come our school is doing so badly? And you can't handle. You will have to do something about improving the quality and the standards of your kids. So there were a lot of improvement. I can give you some on access. Preschool shifted from 6 to 7% in 2009, and the access improved to 87% by 2019. And then primary school access, 96%, right, jump up to 98.1% in 2019. Lower secondary school, 91% access to 95.8% in 2019. And upper secondary school, 81% in 2012, jumped to 88.8% in 2019. So access, some improvement. The quality was very varied. So yes, we have been having some improvement. There was some improvement in equity. But my point is this. Those data that I cited there, not nearly enough to satisfy us, because we all want our kids to be far better than we are before. And the reality today is that the other countries are also making huge improvement. So if you're running so hard, and when you open your eyes, some of the other competitors are running even faster than you, you're behind. So I think we have made progress without doubt. But the question is it at the pace that is beating the competition?
Idris, let's talk about leadership. Our ministers come and go. Many of them, they want their legacy, right, to be known. They come in, they change things, they go out, the next minister comes in, changes things. Your thoughts on leadership? I'm sure you've seen enough of that.
Yeah, I think the key here is that if there's change in government, change in leadership, don't start looking at changing the blueprint. There's nothing wrong with the blueprint. So look for ways to ask the question, why is the implementation not working as well? Focus on implementation. Find the areas where shortcoming. Try to solve the problem of implementation. This is the key. So leaders, in my view, are leaders, and I call them leaders, that they intervene by rolling their sleeve to solve problems. If you're not solving problems, then you're not there. So I make life very simple. Rank all the schools. You know which school is not doing well. Tell them they are in band 1 and band 6, band 7. And then you now focus on the schools, as Likai pointed out, or band 6 and 7. Ask the principal what you're doing, the teachers, in which class. So the starting point must always begin in the classroom with the teachers, the principal, and the parents. So everybody else around it are to help those people make it work. So if the principal say, I don't have any proper math teachers in my class, then the person who's responsible in Putrajaya and also in the state, bring a good math teacher and put there. If there's one thing I want people to remember in this discussion, the action begins in classroom. Not the state, not the district, not Putrajaya. It's in the classroom.
Yeah, there's no more UPSR. It's been removed. How do we assess these schools and put them in bands?
I totally disagree with this. And I completely disagree. I'm old school. I don't believe that, you know, our system is ready for that kind of what they do in Finland and Norway. We're not reached that level yet. So we really need exams that are robust. Because if you don't do that, everybody will assess themselves to be top of the notch. To my mind, it is absolutely critical that we really take this bull by the horn. And we cannot, I do not believe, I totally reject the notion that we free-willing this nation, we allow our kids to do what the school to do what they like, no more public exams. I can tell you, I'm going to bet with anybody, few years down the road, we will see this is a misadventure, big time.
I was going to build on two points that interest me. One was identifying which are the best schools, whether this is through assessment results, exam results, or otherwise. I think this is an important part because this is not just about learning from the best schools, but which are the most improved. Because not every school has the same context, the same resources. But if we use the data to find out which are the most improved schools across the country, and schools can learn from those schools, I think that would be really, really powerful. The most improved schools as well as the best. The other point Idris raised, which I'd like to also build on, is he talked about leadership. And I think when we talk about leadership in school system, this is not just at the ministry level. Sorry, minister level. This is critical roles at the ministry level, at the state level, at the district level, and then of course at the school level. As highlighted in the blueprint, 80% of our principals are 50 years old and above. About 40% of principals retire within 4 years. That's a very similar situation for many critical leadership roles across the ministry. So there is a critical need, I think, to look more carefully at succession planning, so that leaders at the school level, at the district, at the state, at the ministry level have the continuity in the runway to really sustain these reforms.
What are we doing about inclusion in schools? And that's one of the shifts, isn't it? Unity in schools. How do you think we're doing in that area?
I always believe education, the purpose of education is not to unite people. The purpose of education is to educate people. That's primary. So if you put that as the primary thing that we needed to do, secondarily, we can then say it can unite people. So we must begin by saying quality education is paramount. I can tell you, if you have the best school, the best student outcome in there, every parent wants to send their kids there, whether they're Indian, whether they're Kalabit, whether even Chinese. So you focus on quality and naturally the unity will come in there.
Let's talk about differentiated learning, Lee Kai. The pandemic has come and, you know, as you said, the gap has widened between the have and have-nots when it comes to education. All children have actually lost out. I think in Malaysia, we've lost out 8 months of school. 80% of classroom time has been lost. How do we fix this? I mean, is differentiated learning a far-fetched idea and will that ever happen in this country?
I think differentiated learning is an approach that is necessary. But I think, you know, in terms of addressing the unfinished learning and the learning loss coming out of the pandemic, I think we need to do much more. This cannot be a business as usual. Kids go back to school once admissions rates are low and we go back to exactly normal as it was in 2009. Our children have gone through periods of schooling where they have not had social interaction. They've fallen behind. Some of the research in some countries, like in the US, for example, are saying that the average child is about 4 or 5 months behind. But from disadvantaged communities, they're 6 or 7 months behind. And that's in the US, where they have not had as much school shutdowns as we have. And if you think about failure being cumulative, we are going back to school in an environment where a lot of our children have not been in school for, as you pointed out, many, many months. The learning is behind. This is no longer about targeted remedial. Do we need to start taking more systemic action? And so it's not about remedial teaching. Every teacher needs to have remedial expertise. Class needs to be a remedial class. Do we rethink our curriculum, at least for the next few years, for this particular cohort? So focus on a more targeted set of learning outcomes, because we just cannot make up for the last 2 years, so we need to adapt. And it's not just about differentiated teaching, differentiated support for schools. And so is there something about thinking about a new mantra? And maybe let's call it, so for example, the concept of improvement. We don't expect every school to reach the same standard. We may not expect every child, every school to reach before the pandemic. But what we can't compromise on is we need every state to improve. We need every district to improve. We need every principal, every school, every teacher, every class, every student to improve every year going forward. It's about improvement. And I think that is, in some ways, a core principle for how do we come out of the pandemic and restore us on the trajectory.
Education gets the largest pie of the country's annual budget. How much is enough, Idris? And is there really an ROI to this?
Well, there's never enough money for anything. But I think here is prioritization. How do you spend that money on? Where do you put it on? So I think with the limited resource that we have, if you focus it exactly, as I said, in the classroom, exactly among the teachers, that does not spend money. You can talk to the 100 high-performing schools. They will tell you this does not require lots of money from government. Facilities are the same as elsewhere. Sekolah Ulu Lubai get flooded twice a year. And how come the schools in Limbang, Sekolah Lubai is better than the rest? So really, when I think about it, if you start looking at the classroom, what is happening there, that does not require a lot of money. So I'm an optimist. But with the limited resource, focusing in the classroom is key. And so that's very, very, very important. Yeah. I do return to the earlier question about the divide. What happened to rural school relative to urban schools because of COVID-19? I totally agree. Across the world, the rural schools are badly hit compared to urban school only because of one thing, the digital divide. And that is a big problem, because if you have to teach people remotely, you need to have better connection on internet. And, if that is not there, then it's very difficult to do. I can tell you, in this generation, people who are listening here, they're wondering, when I joined the Red Race in 1982, there was no PowerPoint, there was no spreadsheet, no email, there was no Zoom. So the world was vastly different when I started working in 1982. And so what the world today is that anything you want to learn today is on YouTube. Today, I find people giving excuses for not improving. I always find that difficult to stomach, because there's so much you can learn today at your fingertips. So I still believe that there's tremendous avenue for people, even the period of this lockdown, to really learn on certain things. If my kids were still going to school, I would have spent all of last year and this year spending my time teaching them whatever was in they're missing in the 8 months. I'm convinced if I did that, I think they would have been doing far better than they went to school. But I have to take the responsibility to go through and search and Google everything that's available on the internet to teach them. That's because they're not going to classroom.
But we need to address that digital divide badly. ICT was outlined in the blueprint. This is way back in 2013. I think in conclusion, it seems that the blueprint is a practical, good document, right? I don't think we want to dispute that there are many flaws in it, but it's obvious that the implementation of it hasn't worked very well at all. Lika, what would be the top three things that you would hope for in terms of implementation going forward?
If I had a wish list and top three priorities, number one goes back to your point earlier about the budget. It's not necessarily, yes, we can never spend enough on education, but we consistently spend as a country 70% more budget on the education system, which in some ways is a strong sign of, but with 70% of the budget going to teacher salaries, the question is, what do we spend the 30% on? So one key thing would be, can we make sure that we're spending on the right things? We're spending on things that really move the needle in terms of teaching quality, professional development, lifting classroom instruction. Number two, are we focusing on strengthening the leadership? Are we focusing on succession planning, supporting our leaders, not necessarily at the ministry level, also at the state level, at the district level, but also very importantly, the school leadership, the principals, the penolonganans, and so on, number two. And number three, this concept of about data. We keep going back to data, data, data. Data allows us to differentiate intervention. Data allows us to identify which schools need help and what type of help. It allows us to deliver support and allows us to deliver accountability. If there were three priorities, those would probably be my wish lists.
Idris?
Number one, focus on the implementation. Don't change the blueprint. Number two, reinstate the ranking of all schools and publish them in band so that you can analyze the data for the schools who are not performing well, etc. Number three, focus on interventions that are coming from the ranking in the school so that you improve the quality. That's very simple. And it's not rocket science. So if you look at the school, they're not doing well, focus. So there's no cop-out in my mind when it gets down to quality education, because the biggest thing that you can do, gift that you can do to a child, is to give quality education.
Idris, we are rooting for you to be Minister of Education.
No, thank you.
Would you consider it?
I've been there, Rila. So my point is, I'm totally prepared to give input. Anytime, any day, anybody want my help, I'm there to help. There's no point about being a minister, and I've been there. It would be a great idea, but all you need to do is to empower the teachers, empower the classroom to do it quite like that. So I think rocket science is there. My boss in Shell once said to me, Idris, the biggest lesson that we can learn is this. The graveyard is full of indispensable people.
Gentlemen, thank you very much for joining us today. Dato' Sri Idris Jala, President and Chairman of Pemandu Associates, and Chen Li Kai, Trustee at Teach for Malaysia and Senior Partner at McKinsey & Co.
That was an edited recording of our second education webinar, Reflections on the Malaysia Education Blueprint, which discussed the ideas behind the blueprint as well as its implementation over the years. You can watch the full webinar on facebook.com/BFM Radio. This webinar series is a collaboration between BFM Media, Identity Foundation and G25 Malaysia. This has been The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.